You're listening to a Radio 1 91 FM podcast.
And now we have got Lydia in the studio. How are you doing, Lydia?
Hello, I'm doing okay. How are you going today?
Very good after that little performance there.
Yeah, it was so cool, huh?
Yeah, super cool. Loved to have it. Some gnarly techie stuff in the studio.
Great
and
work.
I was, when we were talking about data and about sort of, I don't know, absurdism or like, yeah, things like that, it was making me think about what I had talked to you a little bit preemptively about.
Oh.
With especially about copyright being theft and things like that, and makes me think of some of the internet's current state,
and
economics and things like that.
Yeah,
which I believe is what your expertise in is in.
I'd be careful about saying that I have expertise.
Yeah. Okay.
The goal is to maybe get there one day, but who knows if I'll ever feel comfortable saying I'm an expert in anything.
Is that what all the best experts say though? Surely.
maybe this is all a ploy to just make myself actually
raise your
look
expertise.
Smarter.
Yeah. Keep talking like that, and someone will start citing this interview.
Exactly. So what did you think? What resonated with you about what we had talked about before in regards to like copyright and data and where we are with the internet today?
Yeah, well, I find that all of those things kind of resonate with me in different ways, which I feel like lines up with the sort of I don't quite know the best words, which I'm sure this is where we need someone with expertise to speak, but about. Obviously, copyright or IP in particular on the internet being like a way of, initially it sounds like the sort of thing that is good, like someone who creates something deserves some kind of ownership, or if you believe in money being a helpful reward, then they maybe should get some money for what they've done. Otherwise, it might get stolen by other things. And we kind of see a difficult fight for that on the internet, where there's lots of like big crazy neoliberal companies kind of taking over the world, but also just copying each other's products and stealing things from each other and remaking, like, whether that's ultra-cheap manufactured products, like you see coming from countries that have cheaper labor, or digital products, which you see from, like, social media companies from countries that have a bit more, government leniency towards abusive internet policies, where the metas of the world and things like that can just control governments at this point, which is maybe what you studied about a little bit, where because of meta and things like that, or at least all the different social medias, that came to the point where it actually is influencing elections outside of just lobbying.
That was that was very apt. Maybe we should start considering you the expert here. No, that's
thanks,
totally right.
I'm sweating.
there is an idea there that these social media platforms do affect democracy and elections. I guess elections on one hand, and the democratic society on a wider scale on the other hand.
I
just quickly want to go back to your point about like copyright and stuff, and the fact that even though we haven't been able to, like, as a society, make sort of draw the ethical boundaries around what society actually needs or wants or what artists deserve, we're now also contending with the rise of generative AI.
Yeah.
And those are trained off of people's work. So it's like a whole nother kettle of fish to really start considering. There's a lot of ethical considerations there about, who benefits from this, who can be held, accountable. Who should, like you said before, is money even appropriate reward?
Absolutely,
compensation and stuff like that. So I guess, the rise of AI, whether it's, predictive artificial intelligence or generative AI, there's a lot of ramifications for this. And, like you say, some of them are we have to think about what this stuff does to democracy. So, and I guess there's two sorts of things here that I'm considering when I'm looking at the internet's kind of effect on democracy. Mm-hmm. And one of them is the internet itself. So the fact that there is network technology, yeah. everyone's all connected, it's a sort of infrastructure there. Mm-hmm. And then there's also the algorithms. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of the flip side of it, is this technology, or, you know, set of technologies that is based on algorithms, which include what people talk about when they say AI. Mm-hmm. So AI is just a bunch of souped up algorithms, basically. And I mean, on a very simple level, an algorithm is just like a set of instructions. You know, yeah. there are people famously, you know, say, call it like a recipe or something like that. It's a set of steps that are to be followed to produce an outcome. Now, the thing that's different about stuff like predictive AI and generative AI and even, you know, recommendation algorithms on social media is that they are based on machine learning. So, you know, people have probably heard that term machine learning used. And it's basically algorithms that are souped up to learn. Mm-hmm. That's what the name implies. Machine learning. It's a machine that learns. They're trained off of big data sets. And we train them. Mm-hmm. We train them every time we go on to social media and post something. Or when we're doing a captcha to find the motorcycle in the pictures. Mm-hmm. Every time we buy something, we train these algorithms. And we're not just training them. They're also training us in a way. So there is this level of behavioral modification that's going on, and that also affects democracy. But I really want to be very clear that when I say behavioral modification in terms of what algorithms are doing to us, I don't mean that people can just press a button and make us do something and make us like one particular party or not. Mm-hmm. It's a lot more subtle than that. And it's a lot more complicated than that, obviously. So there's certain things that, you know, nudge policies can do. For example, Facebook found that the like button wasn't used nearly as much when it was on the left side of a post. Yeah. Putting it on the right side of a post increased post likes by quite a lot.
Yeah.
So that's like a pretty, you know, obvious case of behavioral modification but it's not what people usually think when you would talk about behavioral active modification. So there's that. There's another way that you know, politics and democracy is affected is that these social platforms, you know, they kind of posit themselves as like the public square. So it's not just where people are getting their news from. It's where people are also debating things. Where they're interacting with these ideas. So, you know, I think something like over half of the internet, over half of people get their main source of news from social media.
Yeah.
And that opens up a whole can of ethical worms. Uh-huh. And this is going to probably affect the way that politicians strategize and run their campaigns.
Yeah.
They're also using algorithms and data analytics and stuff like that to determine what policies they're going to do or how they're going to run their campaigns or who they're going to try and target. So my research is going to focus on the politicians themselves.
Yeah. Okay.
So I'm going to do a little survey and I'm going to ask them about their feelings because, you know, feelings are important.
Yeah.
And there's not been that much research done on the feelings of politicians and their level of awareness or knowledge around this because I know I've been, you know, ranting about how there's all sorts of reasons why this technology, this new kind of organizational model of economics and society around, you know, the digital world is you know, affecting democracy. But what affects democracy and our institutions and the way that things are run is people's perception about it. So I mean, you know, years ago we started hearing about echo chambers, filter bubbles, disinformation, yeah, all these kind of buzzwords about, you know, the social media affecting society. Mm-hmm. You know, that's around the same sort of time when the dead internet theory started,
yeah,
too.
Yeah.
So there's also, you know, people are aware about it. Mm-hmm. And that creates an interesting effect because mm-hmm. that itself changes the way that people do things. It changes the way that people act. And there is actually a decent amount of research that is saying that these effects of people being siloed or channeled or, you know, disinformation proliferating, echo chambers. I mean, obviously, there is a ton of misinformation and disinformation.
Yeah.
That is kind of one of the more legit concerns, I think. But stuff like echo chambers and filter bubbles, mm-hmm. there's a sizable amount of research that the effects are overstated.
Yeah.
But the people perceiving social media to work like that mm-hmm. does have a sizable
effect.
Yeah,
interesting.
So I think that's one of the reasons why it's important to look at people's awareness and their attitudes towards this, because you can look at what's actually happening, but I think you need to have a little, like a solid basis about how people are feeling about it, because it's going to influence the way that they act. And I think in terms of politicians, it really influences the way that they push their campaigns and run their campaigns. You know, you see businesses and stuff really trust AI.
Yeah.
You see them really trust generative AI.
Uh-huh.
So, for example, Duolingo recently, they've been firing all their contractors.
Yeah.
They fired like freaking everyone that works at the company. They're replacing them with generative AI.
Wow.
And that is in spite of the fact that the technology just doesn't really work that good.
Yeah.
It's not good enough to replace these people is what I'm saying.
Yeah.
But it's happening anyway. And so businesses have this confidence in AI. And I think that Silicon Valley does a really good job of selling this technology to do more than it actually does, or to do something different than it actually does. And I think the same thing happened with targeted advertising and Google's click-through rates and stuff like that. Click-through rates on ads have not been tied to, you know, profit. People just like eyeballs on their stuff.
Yeah.
It's a kind of superstition,
yeah.
I think. And I think business people have it. I think, you know, financiers have it when they use their algorithms to determine who to, you know, invest in or whatever. I think that politicians probably have this. And they probably have this sense of how algorithms are used by social media and affect people.
Yeah.
And so I think that it's going to have a pretty big effect on the way they run things just by respect of how they feel.
Yeah. Well,
even if it doesn't.
Yeah.
On a more material level.
I can see how also like what you're talking about with some AI will maximize like a metric, like clicking through an ad or something like that. Or even on Duolingo, it might like get the most people to use Duolingo, you know, the most frequently. Or obviously with Facebook, they create a system so that you stay on that app as long as possible to see the most number of ads. But actually, like if that is like causing that's not holistically economically valid for those companies or helpful for them. Like that might just be causing more and more, you know, brain rot, or more and more people using a product and not actually knowing what they're getting out of it and not actually picking up on what that product is trying to give you. So Duolingo obviously is not actually teaching people languages. Like everyone always complains about how it doesn't teach you a language. It's like helpful for some vocab, but you know, and kind of similar with Facebook. Like you learn to filter out those products or like not see them sometimes. Like that's not true for every case, but you can see how maybe AI is like, if it's fixated on one metric and it like maximizes that, then the sort of supplementary backing that helps a human, you know, helps that metric actually be economically valuable isn't supported, because the AI only knows how to maximize that one thing.
That's so true. That's so true. And it really speaks to the reason why we get conspiracy theories, yeah, like the dead internet theory.
Yeah.
You know, like that was come up with in like 2019 mm-hmm. or something like that. So a while ago now. Mm. And it's just, you know, one of those 4chan
yeah,
originated
yeah.
things.
Right.
And it's crazy how that like kind of inspired a couple of waves of like critical techno skepticism and stuff.
Yep.
Because when you read it, it does kind of like the original post I'm talking about,
uh-huh.
The original post by Illuminati Pirate. I think it was on some weird 4chan
right,
adjacent
okay.
thing. And it's babble, you
uh-huh.
know, it's total bullshit.
Uh-huh.
But it gets at something real, and that's
yeah.
the feeling. It's the feeling that people have of the internet dying, of it being dead. So even though at that point the internet was demonstrably not mostly bots, although it is actually mostly bots nowadays,
right.
we have passed the halfway
okay.
point. Under 50% of traffic on the internet is now real people.
Okay.
Which is pretty crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
But back to that post by Illuminati Pirate, you know, this guy's going a mile a minute. He's talking about how trans people were invented by algorithms
mm-hmm.
and stuff.
Of
and,
course.
that sort of thing. And, you know, it's obviously tied to this conspiracy theory by states,
yeah.
state actors, in order to like dull people and surveil
yeah.
them and stuff. And, you know, again, it's kind of close to the truth there. Like, obviously, the state does surveillance on people. They
yeah.
collect a lot of data.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think they particularly have an interest in, like, proliferating shrimp Jesus
yeah,
all over
yeah.
the internet. I don't think they have a particular interest in hacking into travel agent sites and stuff like
yeah,
that or
yeah.
e-commerce, that sort of thing. Which is where we see a lot of this malicious bot activity actually
uh-huh.
happening. So I think this is a issue. The internet dying, as
uh-huh.
it were, is an issue that's a systemic one, and
yeah.
it's to do with a couple of things. One of them is the organizational model of digital firms and their
uh-huh.
platforms, and how that encourages this kind of speculative, fictitious capital and
uh-huh.
them kind of selling this AI snake oil to everyone.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
And I think that's where it comes from.
Yeah.
I think that's where this dead internet is coming from. I don't think that it's a conspiracy theory
yeah.
Or a conspiracy by states. Although I think that states are conspiring
yeah.
to do dodgy shit over
yeah.
the internet. I'm not a cybersecurity expert
yeah,
or anything
yeah.
like that. That stuff's beyond my wheelhouse. I'm just looking at the kind of more social public sphere
mm-hmm.
type role of the internet and, you know, that sort of thing.
Okay, cool. Well, I was just thinking, if it's okay with you, I might chuck on a little tune and then we'll dip back into our corrido
sure.
in a short second.
Yeah,
but I was
good.
Thinking I would also like to trap you into a little bit of a talk about some of how that's affected, obviously, politics, like voting, and then the rise of populists. And then, as of very recently, a few left-wing people are succeeding over populists.
Mm-hmm.
Or in Romania, they've just had a sort of centrist, liberal, rationalist kind of come
yeah.
over the populist who was kind of
yeah.
using that sort of Facebook aggression and stuff like
mm-hmm,
that.
Mm-hmm,
so I'd love
mm-hmm.
to get into some of that in just a moment, if that's okay.
Sounds great.
Cool. Let's go into some halftime. You're tuned into Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi with Friends of Yours. And then coming up not long after, we're going to have a... Beautiful. You're tuned into Te Reo Irirangi Kotahi on the Friends of Yours show. We had Yoss in before playing some beautiful tunes before their show coming up on Friday with the wonderful Kraus. I'm so stoked to hear there's going to be a
oh,
cool
wow.
show. And Yoss was performing as the software Shareware. Really cool project. So definitely check out some of that.
That's going to be a great show on Friday.
Yeah. Have you seen Kraus a bit before?
I have.
Yeah.
I
feel like it's
been
a,
enjoyable every
yeah,
time.
Every single time I see Kraus, always different, always cool.
Yeah. Yeah.
And before that little break, that tune before was First Reserve with 20 from Aotearoa, and before that, Halftime with Orakau from Kirikiriroa. And I don't know what city First Reserve's from, sorry. And now, in the background, we've got some beautiful Takuya Kuroda. But before that, we were talking about a bit of a whole bunch of stuff. I'm lost. I'm so lost. We're talking about...
Well, there's a lot of things to consider.
Yeah.
You know? when we're talking about society and the digital economy.
Mm. But I was thinking about, obviously, AI and you were sort of talking about Facebook manipulating, not like, you know, not mega maliciously, but manipulating your likes by turning up like buttons and stuff. And obviously, one of the famous ones of that is that Facebook in particular is known for, like, kind of ramping up aggression. Like, people, you know, just the content on it is, like, there to make you want to argue. And so you see a lot of, like, fighting pages. Like, there'll be a page where it's, like, there's a war going on. Like, there's one I've been following recently, which is punk rock bass players. Have you seen that?
And no.
It's just was popping up on my feed. I have no idea why, but, you know, classic Facebook. I swear I don't doom scroll that much at all, but it was just, it was. And it was, like... it had a bunch of people posting a picture of them playing the bass, and they were like, I've been playing a bass in a punk band for ages. And then there'd be like one person who's like, I'm getting really sick of all these bigots on this page. And then there'd be some bigots being like, I'm really sick of you and all your like woke stuff, like ruining this page. And then there'll be like all these like queer people who are posting like pictures of themselves, and then all these bigots will be jumping on being like, you're just like falling for the woke agenda, like you're not really the, you know, gender you say you are or the sexuality you say you are. And then there'll be all these old school punks who'll be like backing up the queers who are like, no, actually the scene came from this, but you know, like it just like fuels this comment section that fuels this engagement that makes people like me who don't follow any of those pages see it, and makes other people join those pages, and then it ends up with this war where people are joining the page, and like some of them, the good guys join enough of the page, so the good guys take over that page and it becomes a good guy page. Or some of them, like what's their Wellington one? It was like Wellington, I don't even know. Can't remember the name. Anyway, like, you know, there's a Welly Watch kind of page or something, and some of those, like, City Watch ones occasionally just get taken over by like, bigots and just become, like, horrible cesspits.
Yes.
And so that has also come to affect politicians, like you were saying.
Mm-hmm.
And which includes obviously some of the populists, like especially like Trump's a really, really good example, and I think often a good kind of behemoth to talk about, like making some of those things really popular, like forcing all these arguments, coming up with a subject that he might have even just found off social media that he wants some champion as his new point of, I hate this sexuality, this minority, or these people coming into our country, taking our jobs, when actually his politics don't even align with that. Like, he's actively using migrant labour and like supports all the businesses that use migrant labour and survive off it, but he like says this rhetoric that gets all the people to vote for him who are in those Facebook things arguing. And then, we've seen that as well in Romania, which I would love to hear about from your perspective, if that's okay.
Yeah, well, I mean, to be honest, I am not, I haven't been following it super closely, but for people who don't know, last year, I think it was in November, there was this election in Romania, and this populist, scare quotes, populist candidate, you know, guy that comes out of nowhere, positions himself as, like, anti-establishment.
Yeah.
He ended up doing very well and winning. And then the courts in Romania decided to famously throw the election results out. So here we see this guy that whose popularity surged through the use of TikTok.
Yeah, wow.
And... he had very clear ties to getting money from the Russian state.
Yeah.
So that's why the courts threw out the decision. They decided that there was too much foreign interference in the election. And so I guess we can think of that as a way that, you know, the internet is affecting democracy. But we also have to think about how these are just kind of messy societal processes as well. And a lot of this stuff isn't born out of the internet. But there is a particular quality that the internet brings to this, and the amplification of some of that stuff too, that is directly to do with both the policies of the platforms and its design and the algorithms themselves that make up the recommendation systems. So in Romania, they, you know, there was the guy, they threw the election results out. And the kind of alt-right populists were really hoping to still be able to win.
Yeah.
So they had their they had more elections.
Yeah, and
they
it's just another election. Guy, right?
Yeah, it's another guy. It's another guy from the party that was established already as like the populist party.
Yeah, okay.
So the first that first election where they threw the results out, the guy that came out of nowhere actually came out of nowhere.
Uh-huh.
And he wasn't part of the already established populist party.
Yeah.
But this kind of like right-wing party decided to jump on that whole train.
Mm-hmm.
And they promised the dude that initially won like some like important position.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, last night's results confirmed that the liberal establishment did, you know, win out in the end in Romania.
And it was like a mathematician who's the mayor of Bucharest.
Yeah. So he's the mayor of the capital city, largest city in Romania. And, you know, he's just a neoliberal
guy. Seemed like it. intelligent one though, which is, you know, it's a good argument against populists, I suppose. In terms of like who you'd vote for, like
I mean, I'm not sure how much Romanians respond to that particularly.
The IQ.
But what they do like is they like Europe.
They like
the EU.
Yeah.
They really like I mean it's not the most, like, it's not a utopia in Romania at all, far from it, but you know, they've seen their living standards improve like drastically.
Yeah.
And I think people there kind of enjoy having improved human rights, and they enjoy being able to go to Italy or France or whatever to work and send money back. And Romania has historically been very into Western Europe as well. They're very keen on Western Europe.
Mm-hmm.
Even though there's, you know, there is like a very orthodox conservative sort of like established base there too. So you do have to consider that.
Yeah.
That is part of the popularity of the more quote-unquote populist ideas.
Mm-hmm.
But as far as populism actually goes in Romania, what the people like is they like civil liberties and they like the EU.
Right.
And so that's one of the reasons why I think Moldova is consistently voting for more pro-EU stuff is because they see what's happened in Romania and they want that. They want a slice of that pie.
Right.
You know, and I think part of that is to do with luck a little bit because, you know, Romania could have been another Greece situation where they ended up getting the short end of the stick in the EU.
Mm-hmm.
And it, you know, could have ended up in crises and stuff like that. But that didn't end up happening. And I think that worked in the favor of the more kind of liberal pro, I mean, they're all pro-capitalist, but the more like liberal establishment that is in Romania, to what extent it even exists. I mean, it's very corrupt there. But yeah, I think that's something that no amount of propagandizing can really change. And that goes back to what I was talking about in terms of behavioral modification before. Mm-hmm. We have to be careful about what we mean when we talk about this stuff changing the way we act, because the kind of the way that we interact with these platforms is bidirectional. Mm-hmm. You know, we train them and then they train us to do certain things. Sometimes we will accept the output and sometimes we don't accept the output.
Right. Yeah.
And so it ends up being a pretty complicated relationship.
Mm-hmm.
And one where it's not so clear cut. It's always contextual. So I think that's why it's good to look at the technologies as separate entities. You know, we look at generative AI and predictive AI as different things. We look at social media recommendation as different from generative AI.
Uh-huh.
And we need to look at each election specifically. Mm-hmm. We need to look at each country and cultural context specifically still. We still need to look at all of these messy things that make up, you know, social life and human life. And we can't boil down behavior and social life to algorithms or to figuring out what's going on with those algorithms and learning how they work. So that's kind of the approach that I want to take with my thesis is look at the social context. I think it's really that social embeddedness of this technology that needs to be looked at. And even though it's not a new subject, looking at the social embeddedness of technology, I think that machine learning algorithms are a very novel technology, and it's got new implications for what we have to think about, how this interacts with, you know, human nature. And I use that term, like, for want of a better term, but yeah, I hope you can kind of understand what I'm getting at there.
Of course, Cool. And one of the other subjects that we were on here was the dead internet theory as well, which you were talking about. It's quite strange origin, which I didn't know about before. But that's the internet sort of mostly taken over by AI or regenerative things, or like posts about posts that aren't real. Like there's no like first source material anymore, or the majority of it is like recreated and things like that. Is that something? And I think we were almost talking before about how the initial person who posted about it, was it on 4chan, was kind of crazed, a little bit ridiculous, but obviously even a complaint about anything often has its like roots in reality, and it takes like sometimes the estranged communities to point them out, even if they use really horrible rhetoric or like absolutely silly language that like doesn't hit the nail on the head at all. And so does that mean that you think that that is like a valid way to look at what's happened to the internet, or is it like is it dead? Is it like a post-apocalyptic landscape where the governments just get to choose what they do with it, and companies get to choose what they do with it, and we are losing less and less free will on it? Or there's obviously still places that people get a lot of liberation out of on the internet. People can discover who they are through whatever groups and things on the internet, but also people can share and do things without the eyes of the government as well. Like there's a lot of people doing stuff on Tor or doing like, you know, illegal things through the internet that are like still incredibly popular and successful businesses outside of conventional business and government control. Or like, you know, whatever niche community, like there's millions of people who find solidarity in their niche, you know, furries and things like that, you know.
Well, I do think that is it is a valid way to look at what is happening. So the thing about the theory is that it's posited that, you know, it's already happened, and the government's already controlling your mind, and everything's already controlling your mind. But what's actually happening is that it started happening when they were talking about it, when they started coming up with the idea, because they were feeling like it was different as their feelings. And it, you know, this as this circulates over and over again, you know, every couple of years this will circulate, more people are kind of, you know, waking up to it. And I think that people wake up to it as it's happening. So, you know, the internet is dying. I wouldn't say it's dead yet. I would say it's dying. And we might end up, you know, in a position where it's all brain rot. And
it's like incredibly slow death, though. It's not. It's never going to 100% die.
It's a slow death, and people will start quitting it. When it gets ridiculous, and I think that's because something else will come and take its place. There might be new internets that end up becoming a thing, and this kind of one might end up being some sort of legacy thing.
Web 1.0.
I think, or, I mean, it's Web 2.0 technically. I mean, there's speculation about Web 3.0 becoming a thing, but that would need its own a new sort of network, a new sort of infrastructure.
But it wasn't the what is it, metaverse or something? You know, they have tried. You know,
I mean, I'm not.
Club Penguin tried to be the new internet.
Well, Web 3.0 is supposed to be like based on like blockchain technology. It's supposed to be like cryptocurrency and stuff like that. The thing about what what allowed Web 2.0 to proliferate so hard was the infrastructure behind it. So, you know, famously there was the dot-com boom and bust of the 90s. And, you know, even though it ended up in a bust and the bubble burst, by the end of it, so much infrastructure had been laid, so mm-hmm. much broadband had been rolled out. So even though there was no value in having a digital firm at that point, besides, unless you were one of the big ones, mm-hmm. There was still a huge uptake in people going on the internet, and it yeah. was still really useful. And you know, the kind of the bust also led to a specific kind of organizational model being the survivors
yeah.
of the bust. So, you know, the firms that survived had to carve up the internet into mm-hmm. different spheres of how they were going to make money off it. And that kind of sort of carving up of it still, you know, exists today a little bit. There's a lot of, you know, monopolies mm-hmm. on the internet, basically. I mean, you kind of have to think about it a little bit different mm-hmm. because they're basically positioning themselves as intermediaries. They're becoming
like
the
Google
markets.
Being the thing that you go to, but actually, like, everyone's using the only thing through Google, and they use Google Chrome to access it and things like
yes,
that. Is that.
Yes,
sort of
stuff vaguely? Like that. Well, yeah. I mean, that's on the side of the data collection.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
On the side of the advertising, yeah, Google uh-huh. is the main player there.
Yeah.
You know, like, for example, like media companies and newspapers and stuff like that, they used to handle their own advertising.
Yeah.
Even on the internet.
Yeah.
But nowadays, like 40%
yeah,
of the ads and stuff, it just goes to Google because they use their algorithm to target ads because these media companies, they believe that it's better.
Yeah.
And they don't want to have the sort of like expanded model of having like a digital marketing team
yeah,
that like does all that stuff.
Exactly, yeah. 100%.
So yeah, there's this, you know, underlying kind of neoliberal tendency and yep. logic towards lean business models that mm-hmm. kind of pervades this situation
yeah.
as well. I feel like we've gone off topic a little bit. What was I even talking about with this?
You know, I think we're on it. We started on dead internet theory, and we're talking about monopolies.
Yes.
And I just used Google as an example, which marketing is a good example of that for sure. But yeah, what are these? Because I suppose I feel like, you know, once something's died, like let's say the internet fully dies or passes the threshold where it's 90% dead, then you have a much better perspective to be able to say what it looked like.
Yeah.
And that is what helps you realize who had the monopolies or whatever. Like, it's not until you have the capacity to be historiographic that you can actually, like, phrase what it looks like. Because it's hard to visualize what the internet split into. Like, it's hard to tell what is 50% of the internet.
Yeah.
Is it the word the?
Yeah.
Or is it, you know, illegal pictures. I don't know.
yeah.
But yeah, is that something you feel like we're getting to the phases now where we can analyze it, but it is really, really complicated. And things like the dead internet theory or like viewing what generative AI is doing are the lenses that we're going to have to use to try and view and understand what the internet looks like.
Yeah, that's exactly right. That's exactly right. I think give it another year or two and we're going to start using these lenses of how people are talking about generative AI to look at how things are going on with the state of the dead internet. Because you know, there's this company, I think they're called Thales. Mm-hmm. Thales. They released these, you know, reports about bot traffic on the internet. And, you know, I mentioned before, over half of the traffic on the internet is now bots.
So is that from them, Thales?
Yes, Thales. Okay, it's called the Imperva Bot Report, something like that.
Cool.
I mean, it's a very cited report. I'm not sure exactly how accurate it would be.
But they've got the monopoly on the on the reporting on bots numbers.
Yeah. And, you know, they conveniently sell, like, cybersecurity solutions and stuff like that. Yeah. And they're the ones who are saying, like, 37% of the internet is now malicious bots.
Yeah.
We might have to take it with a little bit of a grain of salt because these guys are the ones selling cybersecurity shit to websites. So,
totally.
But, you know, there's evidence there.
Uh-huh.
There's evidence that there's a hell of a lot of this stuff. And one of the big drivers of it is actually generative AI because it lowers the barrier to entry for people who want to make bots.
Yeah.
Because you can use ChatGPT to make a bot.
Uh-huh.
And so that's what a lot of people are doing right now. Mm-hmm. About a quarter of the malicious bots in particular come from residential IPs. So this isn't even people who are like using like VPNs and stuff like that. This is just people who are on their computer, not with any protection or anything like that.
Yeah.
Going around making malicious bots to try to DDoS attacks on travel agent websites.
Yeah, yeah.
And a quarter of them are just people at home.
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, I think we need to be careful about, you know, ascribing conspiracy to the state of the dead internet. And we need to, you know, obviously we do need to entertain the idea that there might be nefarious dealings somewhere.
Yeah, absolutely.
But it's more like people's individual nefarious aims. And the effects that we're seeing are kind of like a like all that stuff interacting with each other.
Yeah.
And that includes governments and politicians. You know, they have a stake in stuff. Like, you know, we see on Trump's inaugural night, we see those guys, Jeff Bezos and Zuckerberg and stuff, all
surreal.
Standing right next to him. You know, they were standing in front of RFK Jr.
Yeah,
who actually, you know, was working for the government there.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's obvious who Trump is trying to.
And Elon got given his whole department and everything.
Exactly.
Crazy.
Exactly. So you know, you do have to look at that and you do have to say, what is this about?
Yeah,
what's going on here? Obviously, following money is probably something we'll have to do.
Transparent lobbying systems where you can see who is actually paying off each person would really, really help a lot with that. I feel like we struggle with that in Aotearoa. Like, we don't know where and why the National Party is getting so much more money than everybody else.
Yeah.
And, like, we don't actually get to see what that is. Like, if we knew that it was the X types of oil miners and stuff, we are allowed to know a certain amount, but they manage to hide most of it. And so it's silly that you don't get to know if it's those companies or whatever companies. Instead, you're just left to feel like it's a conspiracy and to feel like, you know, you're having to dig into the trenches to find things out until you just give up and be like, screw it, it's all stupid, hate everyone.
Yeah, yeah.
Want to make some data art or something. No offense, yours.
So there's, so there's collusions. There's definitely collusions. There's definitely collaborations.
Yeah.
And there's definitely conspiracy here and there.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But I don't think anybody is conspiring to destroy the internet.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Because they want it to be alive. They want people to use it.
Yeah.
But the problem is the way they're doing it is killing it.
Yeah.
So it's a bit of a balancing act for powerful people.
Mm.
How do you retain power? How do you get more power using this thing that everyone's using without fucking it up so bad? Am I allowed to say that?
You know, let's limit it, but that's
good. Without messing it up so bad that that it's unusable anymore.
Yeah, well, I was... Oh, you know what? I was about to say something, and I'm so, so friggin' lost right now. What were you saying? Where are we at?
So I was saying that, you know, there's a balancing act between keeping the internet alive and doing things that kill it.
Yeah, yeah, and I don't want to just go into, like, huge vagaries about capitalism, but it kind of does remind me about how these sort of neoliberal parties are. It's like extracting wealth. It's not that they support the internet or don't support the internet, just like supporting sort of current economic framework, those parties are just trying to extract as much value from it as possible, but then they have to actually learn how to keep it alive in that process, which I feel like is what you're seeing as well with those, like, social media is an easy one to pick on because we all know that we're using it, but it's really easy to see they're trying to extract every last little bit of value, and so they are the ones ripping it apart, but they're the ones who have to learn how to keep us still going, keep it still alive. Like, the internet's on an IV drip and we're like still sucking at the last teats of it, and it's getting pumped full of, you know, whatever meta can find from wherever.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right.
And I'm absolutely loving this corridor, and I would love if we could have kept going forever, but we've got a live to air coming up soon. But I did want to do one last little tangible question, which is around AI. It's being used in university, so obviously universities are actually using it for their own internal things, which we don't necessarily get told about. They're not transparent about that, but staff have talked about that sort of thing, and everyone kind of knows in every workplace that everyone's using it anyway. But also we do see the university trying to crack down on students using it, because students are using it all the time for essays. It's just a common part of the toolkit that the average student literally straight out of high school will know mm-hmm. how to use.
Yeah,
is that
yeah.
like if you're going to write your first essay, it's very, very likely, unfortunately, for better or worse, that they will open up ChatGPT to help them do that.
Yeah.
And what? How do you see that relationship to this bigger picture that we're talking about, or even just how that affects a student? Should a student care about that? Like, is it their problem? Is it the university's problem? Mm-hmm. Should the university try to regulate that better? Mm-hmm. Should the government try to be stop the university? What do we do about AI affecting our tertiary education?
Right. Okay. There's a lot of things to consider.
Mm.
With that, and I think it's so important to talk about. We really, really need to be talking about this because,
yeah.
you know, like you said, people are already noticing it, changing stuff, and things are changing. So yeah, these conversations are so important to have and have everyone involved in them too.
Yeah.
Obviously, I don't have the a great yeah. answer for everything, but yeah. there are a lot of considerations. Firstly, When you go and sit down and use ChatGPT, you should be considering the environmental impact it has.
Yeah.
The servers and data centers that are used to power this stuff
mm-hmm.
uses so much energy
mm-hmm.
and so much water.
Mm-hmm.
And these hyper data centers that pop up here and there, sometimes in third world countries, sometimes in just more impoverished communities mm-hmm. in developed countries, they always take advantage of the people there. They make life harder for people there. They decimate the local environment by depriving ecological system of water.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, this happens all over, like, South America. It happens in Europe. It's mm-hmm. happening in the United States. You know, there's famous examples in Spain, mm-hmm. Peru, places in the United States. I think there was a place in Oklahoma recently.
Uh-huh.
Oracle is now footing the bill for this massive data center for OpenAI specifically.
Right.
So right now, Microsoft is bankrolling OpenAI. They're using yeah. their data centers. But the That's more right. people that use this stuff, the more of a footprint this stuff is going to have.
Uh-huh.
And this is without mentioning the fact that it's not very useful for doing work. It
yeah,
doesn't do
yeah.
good work. I think a lot of the times it makes more work for people to do rather than it making your job easier. A lot of the times it will get stuff straight up wrong.
Yeah,
it hallucinates
absolutely.
All the time. So you should be really careful about using it because you might end up writing stuff that's just wrong.
Yeah.
That's just straight up not facts.
Mm-hmm.
Do I think there is a place for generative AI in research or in tertiary institutions? I think there is.
Yeah.
In you know, there's utility for yeah. it in certain places. If it could be less wrong about certain
yeah,
things.
Yeah.
You know, like if you might want to mock up a table for
yeah.
something just to get your thoughts together,
yeah.
I think that it's, you know, fine to do stuff like
yeah.
that.
Or I was thinking even students, I think a lot of students want it just for the confidence of a structure. Like they want an essay structure. Like it's scary, you know, coming up with how to put the paragraph order
yeah.
and stuff.
Yeah.
And that actually an AI can do that for them if they put in the information.
It can put like give you an outline that you
yeah.
can try, you know, use.
Yeah.
But I think that the work of actually making this stuff, you need to do it yourself.
Yeah, amen. Yeah.
I think that you can use it to, you can ask it like, hey, who are some people that have talked about this thing?
Mm-hmm.
You know, get some sources from there and stuff. But never rely on what it actually says about those sources.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's going to mix things up. It's going to get things wrong. So you need to be using your critical faculties when you're actually doing research. Because that's the whole point of doing the research.
Mm-hmm.
Is figuring out what's going on rather than asking something else what's going on and then just accepting that answer wholesale.
Mm.
And if you're gonna look at the answer and try work with it, that can end up creating more work for you because you've got to correct what's
yeah,
wrong about
yeah.
it. And you might end up spending so much time correcting what's wrong about it that you'll just end up with a completely different structure than what you had
mm-hmm.
It tell you in the first place. So you might have gotten to the point that you end up getting at quicker and
yeah.
easier and more authentically mm-hmm. if you had just started and finished the work
mm.
yourself. So those are my kind of two main thoughts around it, the cool. environmental implications and the fact that it's just not that good or useful.
Yeah.
And, you know, you got to do stuff yourself. I'm sorry. Like, I know everyone loves being lazy. I love being lazy.
Yeah, and it's really easy to cheat in high school, but, you know, at some point you got to stop.
yeah. Especially if it's something you're into, you know.
Yeah,
like,
exactly,
why would you – it's a little bit degrading, I think, to outsource
your
thoughts like that.
Cool. All right. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Lydia. It was
very
cool to have
you on. It was very lovely. Thanks for having me on.
It makes me wish we could have an even longer little podcast. We should
talk about
annoying stuff.
Pull these threads.
Piss people off.
Connect the dots.
Yeah. That can be the name of the podcast, Connect the Dots with Lydia and P.
Oh, wow. That's great.
Tune in next week. All right. Cool.
That was a Radio 1 91 FM podcast. You can find more of them at r1.co.nz/podcast.